I'll just say to begin with that this is an interview with Mary Kay Rouse, who is Dean of Students. The date is February 11th, 1988. I'm Laura Smale, doing the interview for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives Oral History Project, and we're talking in her office in Bascom Hall. We're going to trace your career in where it began, your interest in the affairs of students. And
well, let me go way back, and let me go back to 1953. When I was 9 years old, I was elected the Girl Scout Cookie Queen. I sold 57 boxes of Girl Scout cookies in my hometown, and I liked it a lot. And from there, I say that only half seriously, but when I was a child and also an adolescent, I was involved in a number of leadership kinds of projects, which to me were lots of fun. I had an older sister who was considered to be very beautiful by the norms of the day. And somewhere as I was growing up, I figured out that I was never going to be beautiful and that I would need to live by my wits. And as a result, I worked very hard in school, and I did well in school. And by my senior year in high school, I decided that I wanted to become the student president, the student council president. And there had never been a female, in that job. And so I ran for the student council presidency and won by a narrow margin. And I enjoyed that role for a year, liked it a lot. And
what year is
that
this
was,
now?
That was 1962.
Uh-huh.
1961, 1962, that I was a senior in high school. And a number of years before that, I had decided that I wanted to go off to college. And I had been saving my money and working at a job in the local movie theater. I sold popcorn and candy, ran the concession, and liked getting a paycheck in my own name. And so I went off to college. I was in upstate New York at the time.
Perhaps since you are talking about your childhood, you might just say something about your parents, what your father did, your mother.
Let's see. This doesn't have to be in logical order or anything. When they do the transcription, they'll straighten things out. Or
well, we'll just call this an brief interjection.
Okay. Well, the truth of the matter is that I come from kind of an unusual family, a very chaotic, disintegrated family. My mother was a homemaker and died very suddenly when I was 12 years old. And my father was a physician who hated medicine and general practice, disliked people, and was very unhappy as a physician, and was ill for a good part of my adolescence, most of my adolescence, and died when I was 17. So I was a very independent person, probably starting with my mother's death. But I had, I guess as I was saying, some goals in my mind in terms of education and some things that I wanted to do. So in 1962, I had saved a fair amount of money from my various jobs, and I was at that time living in upstate New York on the St. Lawrence River, the Thousand Islands. I grew up about 50 miles south of Ottawa, the capital of Ontario, Canada. And so I went off to Michigan State in 1962 in East Lansing.
Why did you choose Michigan State?
I chose Michigan State because my financial situation was very bad, and they were willing to offer me some scholarship money to go there. And so I was essentially a self-supporting college student. Went to Michigan State, which was a large university at that time, not as large as it is now, but large, very diverse, large population of international students and students from, different racial and ethnic groups. And I loved it. I took to it like a fish in water or something like that. I just absolutely loved it. I had good professors. I learned a lot, and I had in my mind that I wanted to study Greek. I'd taken a lot of Latin in high school, and my Latin teacher was always writing words in Greek on the board and saying, well, this Latin word is a derivative of this word Greek. And it really struck me that there was another alphabet at that time. I guess I figured there was only one other alphabet besides the Roman alphabet, and that was the Greek alphabet. I was very impressed with his talking about the roots of democracy being in ancient Greece, and I could hardly wait to take Greek when I was in college.
Do you reflect now upon that major and wonder why you didn't look at something more practical?
Well, let me go on and maybe it'll make more sense to you. I thought that I wanted to be a high school teacher. That was my goal, was to be a teacher. And so I was in my second year at Michigan State, and I did my undergraduate work in 3 years, not because I was any super brilliant kind of person, but because my money was so tight and limited, I took, a lot of credits every semester so that I could graduate, early, because I wasn't at all sure that I could pay for, a fourth year. But in the second year that I was at Michigan State, I learned that there were only 3 high schools in the country where Greek was taught, and that was a revelation to me, and I worried about whether I would be able to get a job, to support myself, given the limited number of openings. So at that point, I was too far into my major to change anything, and I decided not to take any education courses, and I thought, well, I'll have to continue my education and get a master's degree or a PhD so that I can teach, perhaps teach in a junior college or a four-year college. I never thought of myself as being a researcher particularly, but I thought about wanting to teach and work with students, and I had a number of teachers that I really admired that I believe helped me a lot in terms of my own, development. And I also thought about teaching something like Western civilization or history. So the third year that I was in college, I applied for graduate school, and again, money was a critical issue, and I was very, very fortunate to be given a fellowship for graduate school, a fellowship called Woodrow Wilson. I could use that fellowship any place that I wanted, and I chose to go to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, which was in 1965-1966. Interestingly enough, it was in that year that Tom Hayden, the founder of Students for a Democratic Society, founded that organization in Ann Arbor, and that was at the beginning of the protests against the war in Vietnam. It was a very interesting time historically. So I went on to graduate school, and I was intending to get a PhD in classics from University of Michigan. And in the meantime, I met an excellent man and married him, Ken Rouse, who was my husband, who was the director of the chemistry library now, and so he and I were married, and after we had gone to graduate school for a year, I was going to the University of Michigan, and he was going to Michigan State, and we were in this wild commuting situation. We decided that we would take a year off and go to Europe. That is, he was studying German, and that he would continue to study German, and that he had already been to Europe several times, and I had never been, and he thought it would be worthwhile, for me to go, and I was excited about taking some time off from school. So we saved some money, and we went off to Europe, and two things happened that changed the course of my life significantly. One was that he became very seriously ill and had, as it turned out, a long story, but I'll shorten it up. He had a rare form of tuberculosis in his hip joint, and he was hospitalized for the better part of a year. And our first child, Martin, was born unexpectedly. So I was in this situation with a husband who was very seriously ill and a new baby, and trying to figure out how I was going to support the family.
Where is this going
on? This was in Germany. Mm-hmm. And what we did was we came back to the United States with the baby when the baby was 6 weeks old, and my husband was still very ill. And we came back to his mother's house, which is in Lansing, Michigan. And so it was a very bad situation, and I was just about at the point where I was going to go on welfare, or you know, something like that, because there is no money behind us in either, you know, family. And so I got a job as a Kelly girl, as we were called in those days. I was a temporary office person. And I don't know how interesting this is for the project, but it's interesting to me. I took home $50.85 a week, and I paid the babysitter $20 to look after my youngster, and at the same time was going to the hospital evenings and, you know, trying to keep things together. Well, fortunately, my husband had applied for graduate school at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, to continue his PhD in German. And he had been admitted and given a fellowship, but they had postponed his admission until, you know, he became well or well enough to study. And so, again, what happened precisely was he got out of the hospital in November of 1967, and about a week later, I went in and told my boss that I could not support my family on my wages, and that I was going to quit, and I quit. And I came home and I said to my husband, even though the university doesn't start until February, you know, we need to go to Wisconsin early so that I can look for some kind of better job where I can earn some better wages. So we came to Wisconsin on the 1st of December, 1967. We had one friend in Madison, and she rented us an apartment because we couldn't afford to make a trip over and go back. And so we moved into an apartment in Middleton, and I went out pounding the pavement looking for work any place in Madison. And I happened to end up in the admissions office here in the Peterson building, and I walked in and heard that there was an opening for an admissions counselor. And it's a great story, Laura, because they literally had a letter to someone else in the mail that they were going to hire. They weren't very happy about this person, but no one else had come along, and they literally went and retrieved the letter from the outgoing mail basket, and decided to hire me. And that was the 7th of December, 7 days after I'd been here, that I was offered that job. And I went to work on my birthday, and this is significant in terms of Donna Shalala's coming, that my birthday is the 11th of December, and I'll get to that in a little while. But so anyway, I went to work in the admissions office, and I was absolutely thrilled, you know, to have a job. My salary was $6,500 a year, and I thought that I was going to be a woman of wealth and means, which I was, relatively speaking. So I accidentally got into college administration out of economic necessity, and so I started as an admissions counselor, and I worked in admissions 4, 5.5 years. It might be significant to you to know that my first job in admissions was to admit students to the minority program, which at that time was called the 5-year program of tutorial and financial assistance. So my introduction to students and to the University of Wisconsin-Madison was through the eyes of minority students. And we ought to check these figures, but I think that I personally, in those first 2 years that I worked in admissions, admitted the largest class of minority students, undergraduates, that have been admitted to date in the fall of 69. We had a huge class of minority students, and I, of course, came to know each one of them, you know, personally, and learned about their backgrounds. This was the time when there was the black student strike in 1968, and the very able Ruth Doyle was the wonderful director, creator, prime mover of the five-year program. I hope you've done an oral
history. We have an interview with her.
Project with her. And, you know, the minority efforts were just really getting underway. So my feeling, my commitment to minority students, multiculturalism, my commitment to work to eliminate racism, sexism, prejudice, discrimination, those are threads, not sure where they came from, but threads that have run through my life in many, you know, different ways. But it's interesting now that it's 1988 and we're re-examining our commitment in this area, that my own introduction, as I say, came through working with minority students. So anyway, just very very briefly, I worked in admissions for 5.5 years. I was an admissions counselor for 2 years, 2.5 years, and then in 1970, I became an assistant director of admissions in charge of transfer students. I also did a lot of work with foreign students, international students, which has always fascinated me. I love other cultures. I love other, just love other cultures. And I remember reading something by Kurt Vonnegut years ago where he said, if something isn't working in your own culture, fortunately, there are many, many different cultures throughout the world. You can look into, you know, another culture and find something that you can adapt or take in one form or another, which will work in your culture. Anyway, I had the opportunity in admissions really to work with, I worked with welfare mothers in a program called the WIN program. Peg Geisler and I, Peg is in continuing education programs. We used to, we started a brown bag series for a luncheon series for women who wanted to come back and continue their education. I worked with really all different kinds of groups of students when I was in the admissions office, including, as I said, admitting international students in it. It really gave me a very broad background. I worked with a lot of faculty members as head of transfer students when we would evaluate credit from other, you know, institutions. And so I worked as an assistant director in admissions until the summer of 1973.
I would like you to say a little bit more about that, but you can do it later if you wish.
Okay. Maybe I'll do it later.
All right.
In the spring of 1973, there was a job opening in the Dean of Students office working for Dean Paul Ginsberg, and I didn't think that I had the right qualifications, you know, having come out of this classics background and then having worked in admissions, but a person who is now the new secretary of our academic staff, Robert Miller, called me up and said that I ought to go and talk with Dean Ginsberg to see about the job and to learn more about it. And so I did that, and Dean Ginsberg encouraged me to apply for a new job, which at that time was labeled Assistant Dean of Students. And so I applied, and Dean Ginsberg put us through a very long interview process. One of the things that he did that I liked a great deal was he had us all interview his secretary, a woman by the name of Betty Peterson, excellent person who's now retired. And I thought that was significant in that he valued his secretary's, comments, enough such that he would make her part of the interview process. Mm-hmm. I thought, that has to be an unusual, supervisor that holds his clerical staff in that kind of regard. Anyway, it was a long interview process with faculty members and lawyers, and I was very surprised when I got a call from Dean Ginsberg offering me this job, the job as Assistant Dean of Students. So I went to work, came to work with him. You never really worked for Dean Ginsberg, you worked with Dean Ginsberg. And I came to work here in July of 1973 in Bascom, and worked as an assistant dean, and we can go back to that later, maybe. I did a lot of different things. And then last spring, after a lot of soul searching, decided that I would apply for the Dean of Students position when Dean Ginsberg had decided to retire. I applied for the Dean of Students position the day before the deadline. The deadline was the 15th of May, and I applied the 14th, and there were a lot of issues that I needed to wrestle with regard to my family and myself, and anyhow, I applied, and then 2 weeks later, I found out that Donna Shalala had been named chancellor, and I had on a number of occasions read about her and read pieces that she had written, and I was very excited because one of the big considerations in a job like this is, who is the chancellor, and as the dean of students or the dean of the College of Letters and Science or the vice chancellor, can you work, with the people that are in charge? So I was very excited about her appointment. And again, it's a very long interview process for the Dean of Students position. I understand there were 110 candidates, and there was a faculty search and screen committee. And again, it was a very big surprise to me when I was on the 21st of August offered the job as Dean of Students. I didn't hesitate to accept the job when it was offered to me. I didn't say, well, I need to think about this for a weekend. I think I had wrestled with all those issues in the spring, and once I'd made up my mind that I, wanted the job, then when I had the opportunity to take it, to get it, I accepted. Now, I have to tell you that the reason December 11th, which is my birthday, is significant, was significant in 1987, was that two things. One, it marked the 20th anniversary of my having worked for the university, and it was literally the day that Donna Shalala moved to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we had a big party at my house for all my staff, and we invited Donna, but she didn't get in on the plane until didn't get into Madison until about 10:30 that night. So I will always remember that anniversary for those reasons, and really significant day. So anyway, in a nutshell, that's the chronological history, and we can then work back from there. I guess I should tell you that I like the job a lot. I'm having a good time, and I think I'm a very lucky person in that I get paid a handsome salary for doing something that I love to do. My principal reason for applying for the job is that I love working with students. I think I probably have the most interesting job in the university, or at least one of the most interesting jobs. I don't know where I don't know where we go.
Did you have plans for what you must have had for what you would do as dean?
I didn't have any plans, Laura, and that is, I'm speaking really truthfully. I did not expect to get the job. You know, my feeling is that there are a lot of very talented people around, a lot of very talented people, and I know that I'm not, you know, indispensable. I have been very outspoken on certain kinds of issues, and I'm a person who has very definite interests, but I'm not a person that is ambitious in the traditional sense of the word or had a planned career. And I guess, you know, when we get to talking about women's issues, you know, there are lots of people that applied for the Dean of Students position where that was their plan all the way, you know, along. And, you know, as I think I've already indicated, you know, my career to a certain extent has been, you know, accidental. So I didn't really have any specific plans because I didn't expect that I would be, you know, in the position. I kept thinking, well, I'm a token female candidate, or I'd make it into to one round or another. And when I finally realized that I was among the five people whose names had been forwarded to Acting Chancellor Cohen, I said to myself, this is getting serious. This is getting really serious. I can't be a token candidate anymore because they don't put token candidates into the top five. They may put them into the top nine or the top, you know, 15. And so I was very flattered, of course, you know, to know that, you know, that I was among the top five. So I was, for about the first month, I was in a state of shock as far as I say, not having made specific plans. On the other hand, you know, in a way, I suppose you could say I've been preparing for this job, you know, all my life. And one of the first things that I did was I have 30 people who are working with me. There are five units of the Dean of Students Operations. And I interviewed each one of those people for an hour and wanted to take time for them to get a chance to meet me and for me to meet them and to find out what they liked about their jobs and what they didn't like. And anyway, I did pull myself together, and you know, it didn't take me a long time to figure out, you know, some of the things that I wanted to do. I don't know exactly where to go from here, but one issue that is extremely important to me is how we women and men, how we women who are mothers and homemakers, how we are able to successfully work inside our homes and outside our homes. A thread that has run all the way through my life is my concern for children and families, which goes way beyond, you know, my own children. And children are our most valuable natural resource. There's no question in my mind. And, you know, it's important to me. What's happening in Bascom, or what we're doing now, is every bit as important to me as what's happening to my youngest child, who's now 11 years old and is a fifth grader at Randall School. And I think we've got to figure out ways to do an excellent job in both arenas. There's been sort of this headlong collision of the traditional world of work and family, and, you know, how are we going to be able to successfully do a good job in both arenas? And that's a theme that is very important to me. For instance, one of the things I said to every one of my employees is, you know, if you decide you want to have a baby, or, you know, if a man comes in and says to me, you know, he is going to be a father, my response is, congratulations, that's wonderful. What can we do such that, you know, you'll be able to raise your family and not feel, you know, terribly pressured, and at the same time continue to be a valuable employee here? Do you need to work Go ahead. You know, I would say to an employee, you know, do you need to work 80% time instead of 100% time or 60% time, you know, so that you can you know, successfully raise your family, which is, you know, extremely important. In fact, there's some research that says that the most stressful time in the life of a family is when the children are, you know, infants through six-year-olds. Lots of times we think, well, it's when we have adolescents, but in fact it is very difficult when you know, have responsibility for infants and toddlers and preschoolers. And so that is a theme that, you know, a thread that, as I say, has run through my life. And one of my goals is to, you know, help figure out, you know, how we're going to do both with, you know, women working outside their homes out of economic necessity, which was always my case, or women working outside their homes because they want to be working outside their homes. And so that's a real important theme, but I forgot where I was going with that.
Well, it would be very interesting to have you talk about how you achieved it in your own case, uh-huh. and how you have the flexibility, whether you're managing to do it with the others, mm-hmm. though perhaps we should go into that later. Mm-hmm. I mean, as we go back in more detail. Mm-hmm. Though I would like you to answer the question why you were selected as dean then. You must know that.
Why I was selected as dean? Gosh. That's a hard question. I have done a number of things over the years. Started programs.
Well, I don't mean that so much as I mean obviously, uh-huh. you wouldn't have gotten to the top five, uh-huh. if you didn't have very good qualifications. But uh-huh. did they say to you what particular thing about it was that made them decide?
No, as a matter of fact, maybe I'm going to see Bernie Cohen this afternoon. Maybe I ought to ask him. They must have seen leadership. Mm-hmm. They must have seen leadership. They must have seen a very independent individual. I hope that they saw an individual with high ethics and integrity and some vision. You know, I think mm-hmm. I have some vision.
I would assume all the five candidates would have those things, wouldn't
some, maybe? Issues. I certainly have a fair amount of passion for, you know, certain kinds of kinds of things. But gosh, that's I have a sense of humor.
had you demonstrated, did you know that you had administrative ability?
I knew that I had administrative ability in terms of being able to get projects and programs up and running. I mean, I've chaired lots of different committees. You know, I have a demonstrated record of being able to get the job done. You know, to Karl Popper, the historian. I'm sure you know his work. I remember reading a remark of his where he said the real genius is the person who can get the job done, who can implement the idea, the project. And I think that certainly I'm very good on follow-through. One thing that they might have seen, and I don't know how important it is, but I have considerable ties to the community, both local and countywide and statewide. I'm a person that believes that the university needs to contribute, you know, to the community, and so I have a lot of different ties. I don't know whether that was, you know, significant in their selection, but I don't know.
Did you know who the other candidates were?
Only in the grossest sort of way, and by gross, I would say that I knew by sex and by race, and I hope that. That I will live long enough such that we don't talk about black people and white people and red people and and green people. So I knew that there was a, and this again, this is very gross. There was a black man. There was a white woman. And then two white males in the pool.
Were they UW people?
One was from the university, and the other three were from outside the university. I don't think I answered your question very well. It's hard.
Well, I rather thought that they would have said, "We have decided to take you because of this and that," but evidently they didn't.
Yeah. It was very funny. Again, I don't know whether I'm boring the. But boring
no,
you
were.
The way it turned out, actually, maybe I will tell you this. The interviews, the final round of interviews was in late July, and they told us that they would let us know at the very beginning of August, you know, who had been selected. And the process had taken longer, you know, in keeping with Murphy's Law, that everything takes longer than you think it's going to take. And I had urged the people with whom I interviewed in late July, people on the chancellor's staff, to make a decision quickly because school would be, you know, starting. And so we didn't hear and didn't hear anything. And finally, I guess it would have been the beginning of the week. August 21st was a Friday, so whatever that would have been the 17th, August 17th, I got a call saying that I should come to an appointment with the chancellor on that Friday at 10:30 in the morning. And I figured at that point that they had gotten a candidate from the outside, and they said that they would be making the announcement on Friday. Mm-hmm. And they always tell the people that haven't been selected first, you know, and then they make, you know, the announcement. And so I really had settled in my mind that, you know, someone else had been, you know, selected, and I had the feeling that maybe they wanted to make a change and bring someone in from the outside. And so I was most surprised. In fact, you could interview Bernie Cohen and he would substantiate this. When he offered me the job, I actually asked him if he was kidding. And he said, "Would I kid about something like that?" And I said, "Well, I hope not." And so, believe you me, it was just as a, I don't know if you saw the newspapers, but it was a big, very big surprise. And I was the last person to know. Actually, they told all the other candidates that they had not been selected, and then offered me the job at the tail end, which is a complete reversal from what they ordinarily do. And they had me sized up pretty well because they had the news story already written, and they must have figured that I would take the job. So maybe people know me better than that. So anyway, it was really exciting in that sense that I was a real surprise.
And you didn't, Donna Shalala didn't talk to you at all, as I, or did she?
She did not. She called me immediately. She called me. Did she call me that Friday? Gosh, that was such an exciting day. She did not call me that Friday. She called me on Monday.
But she hadn't talked to you beforehand.
She had not talked to me beforehand. Yeah. And she said that she, of course, congratulated me. And then she said that although she had been consulted, that responsibility for the decision belonged to Bernie Cohen, a person for whom I've always had great admiration and respect, but that... that Bernie had made the final decision. And anyway, it was very exciting to hear from her.
You didn't have to interview regents, did you? I mean, don't get involved in this.
I interviewed a faculty search and screen committee that was headed by Booth Fowler from political science. Professor Fowler was an 11-person search and screen committee. And then Bernie Cohen set up interviews with 9 people besides himself in the administration.
Okay. 9 people.
9 people. For the record, males.
There would be many alternatives up there.
just in terms of history. In fact, I have to tell you this. Donna Shalala and I were at a community meeting with black leaders that I had organized. And there were 3 of us from the administration. Mercia Lee, who was the highest ranking black administrator, and myself and the chancellor. And at one point, a question was asked by someone. He said something like, well, you need to study your administration and determine how many minority people and how many women you have. And it was, you know, it was a very lengthy question. To which Donna Shalala replied, I don't really have to study this. I can tell you what the profile of the administration is in terms of women and minorities. They're right here with me in the room. There's Mary Rouse, the Dean of Students, and there's Mercia Lee, Assistant Vice Chancellor. And they're right here.
Yeah. So it's really telling.
I certainly don't think that I was given the job because of my gender. I would be crushed if I found that to be true, and I have not had any indication that was the case. I firmly believe that I'm here because I worked very hard, over a long period of time, plus whatever people see as my potential. And mm-hmm. I would be very disappointed to think that, you know, I had gotten the job because of my gender.
When they interviewed you, they must have asked you what you would do as dean,
mm-hmm.
and what you thought of the way the structure as it was, and how you would change it.
I certainly did talk about a number of things that I thought needed to be changed. First of all, we need more advocacy in general for student services, and we need to help faculty and other staff around the campus understand the role that we play. In other words, you know, I don't ever want to try to be a faculty member, but I want faculty members to know that we're here to help them with student concerns, student problems. In other words, that we have a unique, you know, role in student services. I don't feel that I'm a second class or anything like that. I feel that I'm engaged in a cooperative venture in higher education. Just as librarians have a unique, you know, role in the campus, and faculty members need librarians and librarians need faculty members, I feel the same way. I firmly believe and am happy that the new chancellor concurs that we have not been doing enough for our new students, and that's something I've talked about for some time, that we need to, the chancellor says it very simply, she says the freshmen belong to us, that we need to expand our summer orientation program, that we need to do a lot more to acquaint our students with what I would call the culture of the university.
So was this Playfair your idea then?
This was certainly my idea in terms of interviewing. It turns out that it dovetails very nicely with the chancellor. I mean, we're right in sync, on these things. In fact, so far we have agreed on everything. It's uncanny. So I had certainly talked about the need to get our freshmen, as well as our new graduate students, our new students. My point being that if you invest a lot of time and energy in your new students, that will pay off. You know that just as when you move into a neighborhood, the first 6 months or the first year, you get to know the neighbors, and there's an energy level that you need to put out to get, connected. and your neighbors invest time and energy, you know, they bring over pies, hopefully, or cakes, or, you know, whatever, that when you're adjusting to a community, you know, whether you're coming here from Tanzania or you're coming here from Kankakee, Illinois, that the university needs to spend time on the front end in helping you get acclimated. And so that's something that you're going to be hearing a lot more about.
I think that's marvelous.
In the years to come, and so that's something that is important, and something that I talked about when I interviewed. I also talked about the need for the Dean of Students Office to do more programming. Because we are a large university, we're limited in terms of how much one-on-one direct contact we can have, and I talked about the need to improve what we do for student organizations. For instance, we need more advising and support. We have over 850 registered student organizations. Student organizations are a leadership training ground. You know, we're training people that are going to be in the Senate and the House of Representatives and in Xerox Corporation, and the need to provide leadership training and assistance to student organizations. You know, there's a wonderful man, I'm sure you know his name, Ernest Boyer, who's the head of the Carnegie Commission, and he has a book out, it's a 1987 book called The Undergraduate Experience, and in it he says something that really struck me. There are 168 hours in the week, and the average student spends 60 hours sleeping and eating, another roughly 50 hours in class and studying, and that leaves about 60 hours for, rattling around, so to speak, everything else. And that the out-of-classroom experience, and this is the point he makes in his book and the point a number of us have been making for a long time, that what happens outside the classroom has a dramatic, effect on the college student, whether you're talking about a non-traditional student who's trying to juggle, child care and homemaking in school, or a traditional age college student. And what happens outside the classroom is important, and we need to, make everyone in the community aware that establishing a non-alcohol dance room, for instance, over in Union South, which has been done this semester, is, important, that we need social programming that is not focused, on alcohol. And so that this out-of-classroom experience is real important, or, having a student, involved in an international student organization, or, all these kinds of things are important. So anyhow, I talked about those kinds of things when I interviewed. I also talked about my long-standing commitment to eliminating all the isms, racism, sexism, discrimination, prejudice, we're talking about stereotypes of Indians from East India, or stereotypes about American Indians, or sexual harassment, or, that we need to work together to, eliminate, all these things. And that's a, very strong commitment on my part that, as I say, goes back to childhood. My mother had polio, and she was somewhat disabled from the polio, and she was very ashamed of it. And I can remember being on the playground and hearing jokes. When I was in the second or third grade, there were a whole set of jokes about people who were disabled. And I can remember being very bothered by that. And even though, I think I have a good sense of humor, I'm more like Jack Benny. I'm more inclined to make fun of myself. I don't think I ever direct humor toward any, individual, specific individual, in a derogatory, kind of way. And so anyway, when I interviewed, I talked a lot about my working in programs that would help us, eliminate racism, mm-hmm. discrimination, and prejudice. Trying to think what else I talked about. I must have talked a lot in those interviews. Well, there are just lots of things that need to be done in student services. We need to make sure that we take care of our troubled students, which is part of the legacy of the wonderful Paul Ginsberg, that he was always interested in making sure that a student who was in trouble or in crisis, mental health crisis or financial crisis, that even though the university is very large, that we find a way to personalize the university, to make it small and make parents and students realize that we can reach out in individual situations. For instance, yesterday I talked with a woman by the name of, her name is Ms. Koneman, and she is the mother of our student who is missing in Columbia. And I had a conversation with her in terms of telling her, first of all, that I was very sorry that her son is missing. He has not been heard from since late September. And secondly, on behalf of both the chancellor and myself, to ask if there is anything that, you know, that we can do. And we always need to be able to take time to deal with those
situations. Did you initiate that, or did she come to you?
We initiated that. Mm. You know, any time there is an accident or a death, you know, I get a hold of the family, or, you know, a serious illness, or someone on our staff, you know, does to you know, reach out, you know, in a personal way. I, again, as a mother of, I didn't tell you about my children. I have three children. Two of them are 20, and the younger one that I mentioned earlier is 11. And, you know, in those situations, I can always imagine that, you know, it would be me waiting for word about my own, one of my own youngsters. And so anyway, I think that's a very important legacy that Dean Ginsberg left, you know, in caring about individuals and making the university small and humanizing university. And it seems to be also very much in keeping, again, with our new chancellor and what her feelings are, you know, as far as the ambiance. You know, she talks about making the campus user-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly agree with that.
It's almost 9:30.
Okay.
Do you...
Shall we quit?
Well...
Okay. Okay.
I was going to ask you whether they wanted you to change things. I'm interviewing Paul Ginsberg.
Good.
And he said he thought there was going to be a good deal of change in the student dean's office.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't pursued this, but does this come from you or from higher up, people wanting changes?
It comes, a great deal of it comes from me. In other words, I think that that Dean Ginsberg has left a wonderful legacy, and you know, from him I learned many things, and I think what we need to do is to preserve that legacy of caring, that wonderful legacy of caring, at the same time. You know, to build on that and to make a number of changes. It's a different era. It's a very different era now that we're in. And so I would say a great deal of the change comes from me. We also, for the first time in my tenure on the campus, which, as I said, is just over 20 years, have a chancellor who is attentive to student life and interests, and who has some ideas about student affairs. As you will find when you interview Paul, he operated pretty independent of the administration. He, you know, essentially, in quotation marks around this, did his own thing.
Yes, he did say that. Very
the jargon. And so now we have my being included in the chancellor's cabinet, so to speak, and we have a team, you know, a different team. So I expect that you're going to see a lot of change, and a lot of it comes directly from me. I do believe that you have to move with the times.
Did this your being in the Chancellor's Cabinet come about under Bernie Cohen, or did it start with when Donna Shalala came in?
It started with Donna, who asked me if I would like to be included in the Cabinet when she came to see me last fall. And I can remember exactly what phrase I used. I said, that is music to my ears, and I would love to be included, because I feel that I'm not only representing the Dean of Students Office, but representing the interests of undergraduate advisors and admissions and financial aids. I mean, these are wonderful colleagues of mine. In fact, I ought to tell you that when I wrote my letter to the Search and Screen Committee, I said that there were two reasons for my wanting the job. The first was that I absolutely love working with college students. I love the population. I love the diversity and the different kinds of students. And then secondly, that I think we have what I call a tradition of excellence in student affairs around the campus or student services, and that, you know, I can call up a colleague in admissions or a colleague in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences Dean's Office, and we can work, you know, together to help a student. And so that, you know, I wanted to build on this tradition of excellence among my colleagues. And then, of course, the third reason I already mentioned emerged 2 weeks after I applied, which was the appointment of the chancellor. So there are really, you know, three reasons. Did I get off the subject, Laura?
No.
I'm...
Well, it was because you were going to be in the Chancellor's Cabinet,
yeah,
you wanted to represent these various groups.
Right.
And you're making the point about a tradition of excellence and consulting colleagues reminds me of a comment that a friend of mine, Marion Lanes, has made, which is that, do you know her?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what the difference between staff and line is, but that the difficulty of communicating with one kind of colleague on campus, that apparently, is it the channels come to one spot but don't go this way?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking
mm-hmm.
about?
Mm-hmm.
And is that something you can change?
Well, we are doing some things. You know, as you know, the campus is decentralized, and we don't have a division of student affairs as they do at some other, you know, institutions. But what I did last fall was to create a group which is called the Student Services Directors, and these are all the people in student services. The director of the University Health Service, the director of the Wisconsin Union, admissions, financial aids, all the units that are directly connected with student services. We all now get together once a month in the same room, which is exciting. I mean, I didn't have any trouble getting people to add another meeting to their calendar, because this is something they've really wanted. They haven't come together like that, you know, for a very long time. Mm-hmm. There used to be a vice chancellor for student affairs. You may, may know him or know of him. F. Chandler Young was the last vice chancellor for student affairs.
And the first one, I think. Was
perhaps the first one, too. And another one of my goals that I talked about when I interviewed was, how are we going to get better connected in terms of networking, so that the right hand knows what the left hand, you know, is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Are we out of date?
Little light is flashing. And yes, we'll have to stop.
Okay.